detail, no, how they do this. I start by a discussion about the invariants one can build from tensors, and I will give some graphical representation of these invariants. Then I will associate some topological information to this graph. So here you will see the triangulations arriving. Then I will discuss a bit the combinatorics of the graphs, and namely I will define for you a number, which is a very interesting number called the degree. And then I will write some action. I will obtain graphs as Feynman graphs. And I will explain to you that like in matrix models, these Feynman graphs, their amplitude supports one over n expansion, which I'll you know, precisely define what I mean by this. Okay, so this is kind of the plan of what I will be doing today. So first, the starting point of, I should start by saying that this is more, if you want, like a didactical introduction. So I'll try to be thorough and present all the details, but it's more like a lecture on this topic. So I'm not giving much of interpretation or usefulness of such models. I'm just describing to you what they are. Good. So first, what is a tensor? So a tensor is an object which has indices. You know, let's say that it has d indices. And I will discuss from now on only about tensors which, are complex tensors. So I'll say that these are numbers in the complex numbers. And I'll discuss about tensors which transform under what we call the external tensor product of fundamental representation of U of N. Now, the important word here is external. So what does this mean? It means that these tensors, the indices are distinguished and they each change, each index transforms with a distinct unitary transformation. So I will take an index tensor which will transform, let's say in a new basis B1 BD, we'll have some unitary operator. It'll be the application of a different unitary operator on each index. So this is a sum over some indices, A1 to AD, some unitary from B1 to A1, some distinct unitary from B to A2, up to some unitary on the last index, A1A. Good. So this is a transformation property of my tensor. So now I told you everything you need to know about this tensor. You know, it's a tensor which transforms like this under the external tensor product of fundamental representation of U of N. Now, because it's a complex number, yes? Okay, prime. Good. Now, because this number is a complex number, I can look at how the complex conjugate tensor transforms. So if I put here a bar, I just pick up bars all over them. So this equation holds with or without the bar. Good. So the first question I'll be asking myself, I want to write quantities which are invariant. They depend on this tensor, and they're invariant under this transformation. So my purpose is to build invariants out of this tensor. So what is an invariant? An invariant, it's easy to understand. It's like it's a contraction of tensor indices. So it's an object which depends on tensor entries, A1, AD, D bars, P1, BD. And I have a certain number of tensor entries. And I start contracting the indices. So it's something which has some delta functions which identify my indices 2 by 2, and contracts pairs of indices. Now, because the transformation property of my tensors is this one with a different unitary on each index, I cannot contract the indices, randomly. So I always need to contract the first index on a tensor T with a first index on a tensor T bar. So I always need, when I do this, I always see that the same unitary contracts with itself. So this gives me, an invariant quantity. So I cannot contract the first index with a second index or with a third index. So I see that in this, because of this invariance property I require, these kinds of invariants, they're very special, So the rules are the following, They are built by contracting an index, let's say on the position 1, 2, up to D on the tensor T with an index which is exactly on the same position on a tensor T-bar. Good. So there are, yes. Yes, yes, yes.
What would happen if you were contracting with some kind of Lorentzian, I mean, like Minkowski step or something like that? I mean, of course, I guess the group wouldn't be well, the invariance group, maybe, I guess, right?
Yes, because I need to have u dag equal 1.
Right.
So it would be some, I don't know, if you start flipping signs, you would get some.
From Lorentz, I mean, it's not going to be un, it's going to be the Lorentz group.
It'll be the Lorentz group.
How is it affecting your model? I mean, people have looked at that?
Not as far as I know. So what I can tell you is that some things will go through. For instance, what I'm going to tell you next about how I represent these invariants and so on goes through. At some point later on, I start building graphs and computing amplitudes, and that might change if I start changing the amplitudes. Might change if I start changing the signature of this thing. You know? But yeah, the graphical representation holds. So let's go to the graphical representation. Now here you see that I can build many invariants up here. You know, if I have three tensors T and three tensors T bar, well, there are many ways I can contract them. No? This is very, very different from what happens, for instance, with matrices. If these guys had only two indices, there is basically only one invariant I can build, because matrices, they, you know, they can be multiplied. And the only invariant I can build, it's a trace of a power of the matrix. So I use the multiplication to multiply my matrix and take a trace in the end for the last contraction of an index. For tensors, this is not the case. I have many invariants, you know? So for every invariant, I'll give a representation as a colored graph. So every invariant, I'll be represented as a what I call a decolored graph. So first, I'll explain to you how I build it, and then I can also give you a definition, more formal, if you want. So how do I build it? Well, so I have T's and I have T-bars in my invariant. So for every T, I will draw a white vertex. It's a vertex, you know, a hollow vertex. Now for every T-bar, I will draw a solid vertex. And well, whenever I have a contraction between two indices, you know, so the indices belong to some tensors, so I'll represent a contraction. Contraction by a line, which will do what? It will connect the two vertices which represent the tensors whose indices I contracted. So it's a line which connects a vertex like this to a vertex like this. And because the index I'm contracting has a specified position, I can color this line by the position on the index. So this is a line which inherits the position, henceforth called color, of the index. Good, so let's give some examples. So the simplest invariant one can build, it's an invariant which has one tensor T, one tensor T bar, you know, and it's something which looks like this. It's a, you know, T A1 AD, T bar P1 PD, delta A1 P1 up to delta AD. PD and everybody sum. So this is the simplest invariant I can build. You know? So how do I represent this as a graph? I have a white vertex for the T, a black vertex for the T bar. And for every of this index, you know, I draw a line. So this is a line which has a color 1, which represents the contraction of the first index. I have a line of color 2, which represents the contraction of the second index, and so on and so forth, up to the last one, which is a line of color D. So quadratic invariants, I have only one. You know? So let's go to higher degree invariants. Let's say, let's look at quartic invariants. So they are things which have a T bar, a T and a T bar. And to simplify my drawings, I will set now D equals 3 here, you know, for this drawing. So, well, I can draw several invariants. For instance, one invariant I can draw looks like this. H. So I can call these lines 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, and 3. So what does this represent? I have two T's. Two T bars. The first index of this T is contracted with the first index here. The second index of this T is contracted with the second index of this T bar. And the third one with this one here. So if you want, I will even write this one explicitly. No? So I'll call the indices attached to this vertex A, the indices attached to this vertex B, the ones attached here P, and the ones attached here Q. So this is what? This is a T, A1, A2, A3 for this one, a T, B1, B2, B3 for the second vertex, a T bar, P1, P2, P3, and the T bar, Q1, Q2, Q3. And now say the identifications. So how do they go? I identify the index A1 with the P1, an index A2 identifying to the Q2, the index A3 with Q3, then the index B1 is identified with Q1, B2 is identified with Q2, and B3 is identified with Q3. Good. So this is an invariant, you know, sum over everybody, and this is its associated colored graph. So obviously, I can draw different invariants, you know. For instance, one which is different, it's one which looks similar, but connects the indices 1, 2 here, 1, 2 here, and 3, 3. A different graph. Good. So in conclusion, all invariants can be represented as graphs, you know, having vertices, white and black, and lines, you know. So what are the properties of these d-colored graphs? Each, you know, of these vertices has coordination d, you know, I have d indexes on a tensor, you know, and all the, you know, the lines have colors, and every vertex sees all the colors exactly once. So I have exactly a line of color 1 on every vertex, 1 of color 2, 1 of color 3, which represents where its first index, its second index, its third index, and so on contract. Okay, so let me just give here a very, very short definition. So the d-colored graphs have two classes of vertices. And they have colored lines with colors 1 up to d. All the vertices are d-valent. And all colors touch every vertex. Good. So we saw these graphs arising when I studied the invariants of tensors. So I'll be doing two things with the graphs right now, so we can forget a bit for where they came from. Yes?
So each index could be associated with a different
UM representation? Yes, it can even be U's of n's of different dimensions if I want. So I could take a U of dimension n1 for the first index, n2 for the second index, and so forth. So certainly I can do that, yeah. Well, for simplicity, I just take everybody to be the same n, but I distinguish the guy. Good, so we've seen these graphs, you know, the colored graphs arising, so now we'll forget a bit where they come from. So I will explain to you that each of these graphs has a topological interpretation. It means something topologically, and then we'll do a bit of combinatorics about it. So first statement, you know, one, I'll set for now d equals 3, and I'll tell you that graphs with three colors represent surfaces. Are dual, if you want, are dual to surfaces. So how do I construct this dual surface? I'll construct it in the following way. For every vertex, I draw a triangle around it. So I have a vertex here, you know. It has lines of colors 1, 2, and 3. So I draw a triangle around it. Do I have a different color? Yeah, well. So this dual triangle, you see that the edges of the triangle, they are dual to the lines I draw here. So these edges, they pick up a color. No? So this line, it's a line of color two in my of color one in my graph. And the one becomes the color of this edge in the dual triangle. I already needed a color. Only black and white. Yellow, good. So dual triangle here. So these colors, they go on the edges of the dual triangle. So the one goes on this edge here, the two goes on this edge, the three goes on this edge. Now, these colors of the edges, they also color the vertices. I have a unique vertex in my triangle, which is common to the edges one and two. This vertex here, which I'll be calling this vertex 1, 2. No? I have a unique vertex common to 1 and 3, which is the vertex here 1, 3, and I have a unique vertex here 2, 3, which is common to 2 and 3. Good. So this is the triangle dual to a vertex, you know. So for the black vertices, I get also dual triangles, you know. 1, 2, and 3. Good. Now a line in my graph, no, will represent a gluing of triangles. So a line of color 2, like this one, is a gluing of two triangles. So this line is a gluing. So which gluing? Well, so it's the unique gluing which respects all the colorings. So this means what? I only glue an edge of color 2 on an edge of color 2 such that the vertex, you know, this was 2, 1, 1, 3, 3. So I respect the coloring over the edge, but I also respect the induced coloring on the vertices. For instance, the vertex here, which was called 1, 2 on the left, is the vertex which is glued on the vertex called 1, 2 on the right, you know? And the vertex which is called 2, 3 on the left, it's glued on the vertex which is called 2, 3 on the right. So each line represents a well-defined unique gluing. You know, I can't play around, you know, I can't interpret it as a different gluing. This is the gluing it represents. Good. So hence, you know, we see that each of these graphs, you know, it's a gluing of triangles. For instance, you know, this one here is a gluing of four triangles. No? Good. So it's a surface. Now, this is about the combinatorics, you know. Now, what happens with colors, with graphs which have more than three colors? You know, let's take now the graphs with four colors. You know? How come? So this is a triangle. This is another triangle.
Yeah, and you glue, so you glue two edges?
On the triangle one, with two edges on the triangle two. Yes, but I never glue the same, you know, I never glue edges on the same triangle because the colors are different. Of course, once I have two triangles, I can glue in between them, for instance, all the three edges, you know. This guy here represented, you know, for the guy with three things, hey, it's exactly two triangles which are completely identified along all edges. Good. So obviously, you know, this guy is a surface. Now, how about four colors? So it's very interesting. I can see the four colors in many ways, you know. So let's look at a vertex with color. So I'll have colors 1, 2, 3, and 4. Each vertex will now be dual to what? To a tetrahedron. No? So my vertex, you know, which has valence 4. Will be dual to a tetrahedron. So let me draw it like this. Okay. So its lines were colored. 1, 2, 3, and 4. Okay. So here I told you that, you know, this lines in the graph were dual to the edges, and the color of the lines passed on the edges. So now the lines in the graph are dual to the triangles. The colors pass on the triangles. So this one, you know, becomes this triangle here. Of color 1, bounding the tetrahedron. This is the triangle of color 1. The 2 is the triangle behind of color 2. The 3 here, you know, I would even need an extra color, but anyways. So this is the 3, the triangle of color 3, and so on and so forth. So each vertex is dual to a colored tetrahedron, and the same rule is respected when a line in the graph represents the unique gluing of a tetrahedron, which respects all the induced colorings. So how many induced colorings I have here? If the triangles are called 1, 2, 3, and 4, the edges, they are common to two triangles, so they have couples of colors. For instance, this edge here is common to the triangles 1 and 3, so it's called 1, 3. No? And even the vertex here, it is common to the triangles 1, 2, and 3, so it has also its colorings 1, 2, 3. So I get induced colorings on everything, starting from my tetrahedron, then I get on the, you know, the triangles have one color, the edges two colors, the vertices three colors. A line in the graph is the unique gluing which respects all these colorings. Good. So this is about the topology of this graph, you know. So if one can make a statement, you know. So we said that a graph here, a closed graph with three colors, it's a surface. So what will a closed graph with four colors be? It will be a gluing of tetrahedra. You know, so the graphs are graphs are surfaces. And here, graphs are, well, so gluing of tetrahedra, it can either be a nice gluing of tetrahedra, which can be, I don't know, a sphere. You know, it can be more generically any manifold. It can be even a bit more singular than that. It can be what we call a pseudo-manifold. So what is a pseudo-manifold? So it's something which looks mostly like a manifold, you know, something which looks, you know, three-dimensional, a bit like a potato. So what makes a manifold a manifold? What makes it is the following. Take any point in my manifold, and I look at the neighborhood around this point. You know, so I zoom here on a neighborhood around the point, and what I find, it's a ball. The neighborhood of every point, it's a ball, a three-dimensional ball. So this is what makes a manifold a manifold. So what happens is that when I start gluing tetrahedra like this, I can generate some points which are a bit singular, meaning that if I look at their neighborhoods, what I see is not a ball. So it's a more complicated object. You know, it's something more complicated, you know? Let's say here complicated. It's a cone over a surface, yes. So if you want, this is a conical singularity, and the point is that a pseudo-manifold, it's, you know, something which looks like a manifold, but it has a finite number of points with conical singularity. I will be talking, we'll be discussing a bit about cones later, you know. So this is why I avoid it being very precise here. We'll see that these cones, they do play a role, you know. So we talked about topology. Now we talk about combinatorics. Okay, so this is the most technical part of the discussion today. So now these graphs, they have vertices, they have lines. Well, they also have more structure and information, obviously, because they encode gluings of objects, you know, these colors hide a lot of structure. So the graphs are made of vertices. They have lines. Well, they also have something which we call faces. So what is a face, you know? A face is defined as a subgraph with two colors. So in the examples here, for instance, I can draw for you, you know, in dashed lines some faces, you know. For instance, let's look at the subgraphs with colors 2 and 3 here, you know. This one is a subgraph with color 2 and 3, so this one is a face, you know. This one here, it's also another subgraph with colors 2 and 3, it's another face, you know. They also have other faces, you know. I can start representing all my faces on a graph if I want, you know, as dashed lines like this, you know. These subgraphs with two color, what do they interest me? So if I look at the topological interpretation, what do they correspond to, you know? So in D equals 3 faces, they have two colors. And they correspond to what? So what does it have two colors in this gluing of triangles? Is the vertices, you know? So the faces are some things, you know, are in the graph. They are the structure in the graph which encodes my vertices, because the vertices in the gluing of triangles have two colors. So the faces, they correspond to vertices in D equals 3. So what happens with three colors? Now with four colors. So what has two colors on the tetrahedron is the edges. So these faces, these subgraphs with two colors, they correspond to edges. And in higher dimensions, if I go and look at the things which have more indices, instead of tetrahedra, I get simplices of higher dimensions, and you know, the simplex is associated to the vertex, the lines, you know, the simplex in D dimension is associated to the vertex, the lines are the D minus one simplices, the edges, which have two colors, will become the D minus two simplices. So these subgraphs with two colors, they encode some information about my gluing of, you know, let's say tetrahedra in three dimensions, is the most, you know. So this corresponds to some simplices. Namely, edges for four colors. and we set points for three colors and so on. Good. Now, obviously, you know, because I said that all the, you know, this coloring is this coloring of on all the lower dimensional simplices, I could look at subgraphs having more than two colors, which will correspond to different things. For instance, if I look at subgraph with three colors, they will correspond to the points in the gluing of tetrahedra. You know, so here I can continue this list and give you other, you know, subgraphs with more or less colors, which encode something about my gluing of, let's say, tetrahedra in three dimensions or triangles. I can't really do more than two colors. So why are these important? Well, I will not really care much about the rest of the of these subgraphs with more colors. I will just concentrate on the faces, and I will give for you a formula which counts how many faces a graph has. Why do I do this? Well, you will see it in the, you know, SQL when I start writing some actions for these tensor models, and you will see that the amplitudes of graph take into account this number of faces and nothing else. So I will need to know how many faces I have in a graph. So the purpose is to count this in a colored graph with a certain number of colors. Good. Can I erase the first blackboard? Okay. Proposition, theorem, however you want to call it. So I take a graph with d colors. No? The number, the total number of faces is d minus 1 times d minus 2. So this is a graph with d colors. Graph with d colors. By 2. So you saw that the graphs have black and white vertices, you know. So I'll denote. I see that the graph has 2p vertices. P of them are white. And the p are, well, black. So, and also by graph, I mean, you know, a connected closed graph for now. Good. So here, what I pick up is the half number of vertices, you know, plus something which has to do with the number of colors, minus this times a number here. Let's say that my graph is called B. Call it B. A curly, a nice calligraphic B. Okay. So up to now, I haven't told you anything. So what I'm telling you now is that this omega of B is a positive number. This is what is important. Good. So I will not try to prove too much this statement because it's actually a bit involved. I'll try to explain it to you. So first, let's see what happens when d equals 3. So we already found some things about the graphs with three colors. We found out that they are surfaces. We found out that they have also faces. So I'll represent a graph in three dimensions, you know, by also representing its faces. So I have these three valent graphs, you know, which initially they looked like this, 1, 2, 3 with a white vertex, and 1, 2, 3 with a black vertex. Now I will add their faces, which I'll add like this, you know. So this was a face 1, 2, this was a face 2, 3, and this was a face T1. So if I draw the faces in my graph with three colors, I get a ribbon graph representation. Every line now becomes a ribbon, you know. And every vertex is an intersection of these ribbons. So why do I do this? Because this is a more familiar representation, you know, of a dual graph to a surface. It's a ribbon graph. Now, what happens if I apply this formula to this kind of graphs in dimension 3, you know? So the number of faces will be 3 minus 1 makes 2, by 2, you know, goes away. 3 minus 2 is 1, so this is p, the half number of vertices, plus 3 minus 1 makes 2, minus 3 minus 2, it's 1, so this is 2, and this number here, you know, omega of 3. So now note that my vertices are trivalent. So the I have two p vertices. I have how many lines do I have? My vertices are trivalent, so I have 3 p lines. I have three times the number of vertices divided by 2, because 3 times the number of vertices gives me the number of half lines, and I divide by 2 to connect the lines. So my graph will have 2p vertices and 3p lines. So this formula can also be written as, you know, p equals 3p minus 2p plus 2 minus twice this number. So what I see is that this formula means that 2p, which is the number of vertices, minus 3p, which is the number of lines, plus f, which is the number of faces, is 2 minus twice this number. So for those of you which are somewhat familiar with ribbon graphs, you immediately understand that this number is the genus of the graph, no? Which, you know, it's a positive number. So in three dimensions, this omega of b, positive number, it's in fact the genus of the graph, which is the genus of the dual surface. Now, in higher dimensions, I can define for you a positive number associated to the graph, which respects this formula. It is a somewhat of a generalization of the genus in higher dimensions. Now, it looks very much like the genus because it intervenes in this formula, but it's very different from the genus because the genus, it's a topological invariant. So I know that this number in for surfaces, it's something which completely characterizes the topology of the surfaces. Now, in higher dimensions, you know, I get this pseudo-manifolds and so on, and this number is not a topological invariant. It's not some magical topological environment which completely encodes the topology in higher dimensions. But it's still a positive number I can define for any graph. Now, there are two options. Either A, I can explain to you a bit how I define this thing, or you can, you know, you just recall that I can define this positive number, and I go to present the tensor models. It's a crucial number in tensor models. So what do you prefer? Do you prefer a proper definition of this guy? Okay, let's give it a proper definition. So now the fact that this number represents the genus for a ribbon graph should inspire us. So you should inspire in the following sense. These graphs have a lot of colors, you know, so they encode a lot of structure. So as I said, I have these faces, but also I have subgraphs with more or less faces. It's a bit too much information to track, you know, in the colored graph. So the purpose would be to try to define some simpler graph, starting from a colored graph, which encodes some information, you know, and it's a bit more tractable. So then I erase here. So the purpose is to define a simpler graph. So starting for a graph with d colors, you know, let's say d equals 4 now. We go into a non-trivial case. Starting from this guy, I want to define some simpler graphs, which encode some information. So first of all, I want to encode some global information about my graph. So I'd like to have all the vertices of my graph B. I also would like to have all the lines but for now I can start you know, deciding to erase some information. So what is simpler than a colored graph? No, as you might have noticed by this drawing, a ribbon graph. So what I'll be trying to build a ribbon graph. So I'll associate some global ribbon graph to my colored graph, you know, which will encode some information. So how do I build a ribbon graph? What makes a ribbon graph a ribbon graph? So what it makes it a ribbon graph is that its lines are ribbons, meaning that, you know, every line belongs to exactly two faces. As you see here, this line belongs to exactly two faces. So if I want to define a ribbon graph, what I need to do is to pick up only some of the faces, not all of them. So I'll just take some of the faces. Namely, such that every line belongs to exactly two faces. So what kind of faces can I choose? So my lines have colors, you know, that's important. You know, they are called 1, 2, 3, and 4. So I will pick up all my lines. So let's say that I want to pick up the face 1, 2. I will make a graph where I have all the lines, all the vertices, and the face 1, 2. But then because I want to pick up a ribbon graph, 2 must belong to a second face, because this face 1, 2 goes along the line of color 2 here. And I need to have a second face, you know, going along the line of color 2 to build a ribbon graph. So let's say that I pick up the face 2, 3, let's say. Then I need again to have 3 belonging to 2 faces. It already belongs here. So I need to put it here, 3 again. And well, I cannot go back to 2 because 2 appears twice. If I go back to 1, I miss the 4. So the only choice is to go 3, 4, and 4, 1. So how do I represent this ribbon graph associated to my color graph? So let's take an easy example. The first one was, the simplest graph was this one, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4. So this was the original color graph. This particular ribbon graph is obtained in the following way. So I take, you know, my color graph, if you want, you know, 1, 2, 4. And I pick up the faces 1, 2. So I pick up this face here, the face 2, 3. So I pick up this face here, the face 3, 4, which is this face here. And finally, the face 4, 1. So now I can basically erase the white decorations inside. And I got this ribbon graph, you know. Notice that this ribbon graph has 4 valent vertices, you know. It has all the lines because it has the lines of color 2, the line of color 3, 1, 2, 3, and 4, you know. It has all the lines, all the vertices, but only some faces. And it's a nice graph because it's a ribbon graph, you know. Now, let's take another color graph and draw this ribbon thing, you know. So another color graph I could be interested in, it's something which looks like this. One, two, three, four, two, one, four. So I'll draw it next to it, you know, my ribbon graph. So for every vertex, I'll draw a 4 valent ribbon vertex. This is the one here. Then I have the one there, the one there, and the last one. Okay. So let me also put the colors on these half lines. So this is 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, and 1, 2, 3, 4. Good. So I see that these two guys are connected. So this gives me here a ribbon line. The 3 is also connected like this, a ribbon line. The 1 goes like this, the 2 goes like this, the 3 goes like this, 4. Good. So, well, like this, for every color graph, I can associate one ribbon graph having exactly these faces. But now, if you recall how I chose these faces, you know, you'll realize that I could have, of course, chosen a different set of faces. I could, for instance, choose a graph which has all the vertices, all the lines, but only the faces 1, 2, 2, 3, and instead of picking 3, 4, sorry. 1, 2, 2, 4, 4, 3, and 3, 1. So this is a different choice of faces, you know, because here I had the face 2, 3. Now I pick up the face 2, 4. You know? And a third choice is 1, 2. No, it's without the 1, 2. It's the one which has the other 2. So it has 3, 2, 2, 4, for 1 and 1, 3. Good. So now this one was relatively easy to draw. So why was it easy to draw? Because I picked up the vertex here and I just represented it as a ribbon vertex, which and I labeled the 1, 2, 3, 4 its lines, you know. Then the ribbon is just followed. Now the other ones are slightly more difficult to represent. Why? Because what I should replace my vertex 1, 2, 3, 4 is, well, it's something which has these faces. So you should have the face 1, 2. So I would have here a face 1, 2. Then I would pick up a face 2, 4. Then I would pick up a face 4, 3. And then a face 3, 1. So in the second ribbon graph, you know, each vertex would look a bit like this, which seems a bit twisted. Now, believe me that this is just an optical illusion, you know. If I draw the graph, I can undo all these twists. And the graph with these faces, it is still just a ribbon graph, you know? And similarly for the third one. Yes, so if you look here, what straightens this vertex is to flip the lines 1 and 2. And because you have two categories of vertices, the white and the black, you know, the black vertex will look like this. 1, 2, 3, 4. So you see that what straightens both vertices is to flip 1 and 2 at the same time. So what you do, you pick up a huge graph, and on all vertices, you flip the lines 1 and 2. And because you flipped on all vertices the line 1 and 2, you automatically straighten the entire graph. Instead of looking, you know, instead of listing your lines 1, 2, 3, 4, you list your half lines. You draw the same faces. You draw everything the same, but instead of listing like this, the half lines around the vertex, you list them in the order 2, 1, 3, 4. And this straightens all your vertices at the same time. So yeah, if you recognize what is this, you know, this is a cyclic permutation of 1, 2, 3, 4. You know, instead of 1, 2, 3, 4, 2, 1, 3, 4, it's a cyclic permutation. So it turns out that these graphs, they are associated to cyclic permutations over the columns, but that's maybe a bit too complicated. So getting back to this story, the story is that, well, each of these graphs, it's a ribbon graph. So each of these graphs has a genus. So this one, for a given colored graph, I have here, you know, this graph obtained like this has a genus, you know, and this graph has obtained like this has a different genus, and this one obtained like this has a different genus, you know. And because they are ribbon graphs, I know that I can count the number of faces I picked here in terms of this genus. For each, for instance, for this graph here, this genus can be used to count how many faces 1, 2, 2, 3, 3, 4, and 4, 1 I have in my graph. The same here, this one can be used to count how many faces 1, 2, 2, 4, 4, 3, and 3, 1 I have in my graph. And the same thing is true for the last one. So each of these genera counts partially the number of faces. So if I add up everybody, I get a counting of a number of faces, or it's a bit of an overcounting. So I need to be careful how many times a certain face appears in different graphs like this, you know, and so on and so forth. I track everything nicely, and I get that formula where this guy is the sum over all such ribbon graphs, which I'll be calling jackets, which are ribbon graphs, of the genus of each of these guys. So it is relatively, you know, it's easy to understand that these genera count the number of faces. So believe me that this is how it ends up appearing in the formula for the total number of faces of a graph. Now, the one thing which is important to notice is that these genera are positive, you know? Hence, this statement now it's clear because these guys are all positive. So this one is certainly a positive number. You know? Second thing, you know, what do they represent topologically? So I have this, let's say, three-dimensional pseudo-manifold. And this guy, it's like a surface because, you know, these graphs with ribbons represent surfaces. It's like a surface embedded, you know, somewhere in my three-dimensional pseudo-manifold. So according to Jimmy, Ryan, which some of you know, these two-dimensional surfaces are Haggard splitting surfaces. So embedded in my three-dimensional graph, I identify three distinct Haggard splitting surfaces. I add up their genera, and this is what gives me this degree in three dimensions. Now, in higher dimensions, I can still define for you ribbon graphs. It's a bit more complicated. It has to do with these cycles I was mentioning here. And I can still adapt their genera, and I get this formula in all dimensions as with this, you know, object called the degree. defined as a sum over some rebound graphs hidden inside my colored graph of their genera. Good. Yes. Yes.
Now, when you draw it on a plane, what you did is that you somehow cyclically ordered 1, 2, 3. So you always draw it like that. And then
yes.
But now for the jacket, you're saying, well, the other way to open the jacket is that suppose I choose another order.
If you want.
And then I draw the. But if I change the order, I'm changing also. So you can view the other jacket as being like the first jacket.
Just with a flipped order.
For the flip graph, when you switch the other graph. But in that case, it seems like at the level of the triangulation. So if you do this flipping, so you start from a graph, and then you decide, OK, I'm going to take another order. I'll go from one triangulation to another triangulation.
What I'll be doing is the following.
Do I get the same topological manifold? Do I get the same topology?
In particular, yes. So if you just relabel the colors and you say, from now on, I'll call the color 1, 4 and the color 4, 1, you just get topologically the same object.
Is it clear? Because the orientation of the faces are going to be the same. The way you order the faces.
So let me, for a moment, call this color 10. You know? And now I will call this one 3. It's just a relabeling. I didn't do anything. And then the color 10, I will call it again 2. As you see, I did not do anything in the orientations, nothing. Because I do it at the same time on everybody.
If you do that, you have to change the. Because you see here, when you drew the tetrahedra, there was only. You started from something which is in the plane, and you make it volumic.
Yes.
So in order to make it volumic, there are several choices that you have to make.
Yes.
Right? So you have to say how the faces are in each other. And that change of order will change this.
It depends. If this permutation on the colors, it's an even permutation, then it doesn't change anything. If it's an odd permutation, then it changes the orientation, which means what? It means that I just need to accompany it by a global flip of black and white, if you want, in my drawing. What was black before becomes white, and what is white becomes black. It's a full symmetry of my theory. You know? It's an exact symmetry for odd even permutations, and it's accompanied by a flip in the vertices. It's also for odd ones. Now, just the last funny thing you could ask, it's, you see that these jackets, so they are surfaces, you know, and for each vertex or for each tetrahedron, I get a patch which is, you know, 4-valent, you know. So that is that somewhere inside my tetrahedron, I have picked a square, which I then glue tetrahedron by tetrahedron to build this jacket surface. So let me just draw for you what this square is, you know. So the square which is identified by a jacket. So let's keep the labeling we had here. 1, 2, 3, 4, the ones which we had here. And let's pick the first jacket here. So let me just not make a mistake. So which one is it? 1, 2, it doesn't have the ones. It doesn't have the ones. So this, the first 4-valent vertex you got here, corresponding to the jacket 1, 2, 2, 3, 3, 4, 4, 1. So notice that this is the jacket which does not have the 1, 3 face in it, and neither the face 2, 4. You know, so these are the two which are missing here. Well, it's represented by a square, you know, in my tetrahedron, which is the square which does not touch the edge 1, 3 and the edge 2, 4. So now you can obviously understand why I have three different surfaces, because inside the tetrahedron I can pick these squares which don't touch opposite edges, you know, in three ways, because I have three couples of opposite edges in the tetrahedron. Now imagine that I pick up this triangulation, and in each tetrahedron I pick up these squares, I glue them together, I get a surface, which is a surface represented by this guy, you know. And the well, because I can choose these squares in three ways, I get three different surfaces. That this guy represents that one? It's a connected surface, and in the graph, it's obviously you see that it's connected in the graph. So what you would need is to me to actually prove this statement. I stated that this square corresponds to that drawing there, and And if you want, I can actually prove that it's a bit, you know, outside what I, you know, just for fun to see what it means. It's not very difficult. So the way in which you see it, it's actually easy, you know. This edge 1-2 here, you see that it corresponds to a face 1-2 in this graph, you know, a face 1-2 in this graph, which corresponds to the point 1-2 of the intersection of this edge 1-2 with this square. And you map all the faces I picked there, you know, as dual to these points. Hence, you get the, you know, square. This is how you see it. Caveat. Okay, let's go back to our business about. So I convinced you there exists this number. It's positive. So finally, you know, after an hour, I get to tensor models. Yes? Can I get to tensor models?
Yeah, no. So in some sense, not only you get a triangulation, but you get a triangulation with a natural, three natural splitting.
Yes.
So what kind of, because in general, there are many big outs.
So which one of them have we picked? I don't know which one of them have we picked, and it would be very interesting. For instance, if I were able to say, no, so this guy is not a topologically invariant. It's the sum of these genera. But we know that out of these splitting surfaces, there exists one topological invariant I can build, which is the infimum of the genera. Mm-hmm. You know, so for every graph, which is every pseudomanifold, I can draw these three surfaces. Obviously, I can look at their genera. And one question which I'm asking myself is the infimum of these guys I drew the full infimum on all of the possible splitting surfaces or not? Or my pseudomanifold? Is that one the topological invariant or not? I don't know. That's an open question, no? But please let me go to test the bottom. Come on. After 1 hour, we need to get there. So, finally, I started by drawing invariants for tensors like color graphs. I explained to you that these color graphs, they represent spaces, you know. I discussed a bit the combinatorics. Finally, we'll write some quantum field theory which has to do with this environment. So the quantum field theory is the following. Let me do we sacrifice them or not? No? Or maybe we keep them. They are important. Let's go on the. So the action I'm going to look at. So it will be an invariant. It will depend on the tensor. And it will be the most general invariant I can write. So what is the most general invariant I can write? Is the sum over all the possible drawings with D colors. No. Connected drawings. I will look at single trace invariant. So this is a connected drawing. Okay. Times the invariant associated to this graph. You know? So recall that, you know, for instance, for this graph, the invariant was pick a t and the t bar with delta functions contract. So all this invariant, I'll be giving it a name. I'll call it the trace indexed by the graph, because this looks a bit like a trace. It's a contraction of indices, but it's indexed by the graph. And it depends on t on t bar. So in this particular case, this was the long one I wrote for you, you know, the explicit sum over A1, C's, Q's, B's, and so on, deltas, T, T, T. All this monster, it's an invariant, I put it here. Now, I will still need to put something in my sum here. I will put a distinct coupling constant for each of these drawings. And I will put a weight, you know? Yes?
Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm playing back to the jackets.
Wow, yes.
This is a short question. If I give you the set of all jackets, can you reconstruct the graph?
If you give me one jacket, but you give it to me properly, that is, you tell me how the lines are colored, I can reconstruct the graph very easily. I squeeze all the lines, and I just draw for you black and white vertices and lines with colors, you know? So it's just that you need to give me the coloring of the lines. No? And this is astonishing because starting from a splitting surface, you build a. Okay. So this is what I'll be putting here. Now, allow me to do something a bit more, to put a scaling for each of these operators, a scaling in N being the size of the tensor indices. So this is a tensor with indices A1 AD, and each of them takes values 1, 2, up to capital N. So for convenience, in order to simplify calculations further, I will put a scale in here. Believe me that nothing changes if I don't put it. It's just that many equalities will become inequalities, and it becomes a bit nastier. So I'll put here a particular scaling with N. And this particular scaling, I'll put it here. Depends on the degree of this drawing, you know. So this is, you know, I put exactly the factor which you pick up here. You know? Now notice that this is a slight suppression. So some guys will not be suppressed at all, namely those for which this number is exactly zero. Some will be slightly suppressed by this number. So I put this small suppression on this coupling, on this operator. Now, I will write for you separately, isolated, you know, the simplest invariant, the quadratic invariant, the one corresponding to this graph. So in this action, I will just write explicitly the first term, you know. So this is a sum over everybody, you know, having at least, you know, having at least 4 vertices. And the first one, I'll write it separately, and as you've seen it already 1,000 times, it's a sum, t a1 ad, t bar p1 bd, delta a1 p1, delta ad pd. Why do I do this? It's because obviously I want to treat this action, you know, to put it in a pass integral, and I want to treat it as a perturbed Gaussian, you know. So I want to treat these guys as perturbations, interactions, and this guy, you know, as some quadratic part. So this will be my action. So what I'll be discussing about now is to evaluate the partition function, you know, which is something which depends on the coupling constants, which is an integral. Sometimes the partition function writes in terms of what we call the free energy. Is integral over everybody, t and t bar, exponential minus a global scaling this time. So here I will put a global scaling times this action depending on t and t bar. Not as far as I can tell. The reason is the following, is that, well, you know, I retract that. I have no clue. So, you know, do it. If you can give them a geometrical interpretation, do it. You know, so, yeah, good. So, what I've done here, I've done the following things. Do you see it? Or maybe you... So, this is the partition function I'm interested in. Here I introduce the free energy. Well, everybody knows that the partition function evaluates as a sum over Feynman graphs, and the free energy is a sum over connected graphs, you know, so maybe I'll be, you know, I'll be restricting to connected graphs, no? I put here a global scaling times this action, and for people who are a bit familiar with matrix models, they will recognize this global scaling, you know, if d equal to, one obtains the usual matrix models, and the scaling here is just n times this action, which depends on the matrix.
We have UN1 times UN2. What would be the other? Is there a nice...
So, there is one thing which I can do, which is interesting. I can choose that exactly the n's corresponding to faces in a jacket are very large, and the other ones are very small. So that will make that my amplitude will be dominated by a jacket and not by the full graph. So I can basically pick up and favor a particular jacket all the time. That's one thing I can do playing on the scale, you know. A priori, if the sizes differ just a little, the 1 over n expansion I'll be presenting is the same. If you put different scalings, so like, you know, some faces are extremely heavy and some are extremely light, then the situation changes. And I can't really tell you how that goes and how it happens, you know. For now, I'm just discussing having, you know, the same n on everybody. Of course, this counting, because it puts everybody on the same footing, you know, and counts all the faces and so on, When I start privileging some with respect to others, it needs to be adapted in an appropriate way. So, no, it needs to be seen how you can do that. Good. So this is my action. Now, my action is evaluated in terms of Feynman graphs, which will happen. I would keep my proposition there. Can I erase this discussion with the jackets? Because I would like to keep the proposition up there. Can I? OK, I erase. So how do these Feynman graphs look like? You know? So I take this guy, you know, this is the quadratic part. These will be expanded in perturbations, meaning I expand in Taylor series considering the coupling constant small. So what I'll be getting, you know, is that this Z will be some sum over graphs, and we'll understand exactly what kind of graphs they are this time, you know, integrals dt dt bar. The quadratic part, I let it alone here, so it is minus n to the power d minus 1 times this sum t t bar, t a1 a t bar b1 bd. Good. And what do I get down? So I get a number of vertices, you know, so I get some coupling constants, you know. I get some scaling factors. So each effective interaction will pick up its scaling here and the global scaling here. So I'll get n to the power d minus 1 minus 2 by d minus 2 factorial omega of b, the product over all the drawings which appear here, you know. Okay. So I get these global things, coupling constants, global scaling, you know, for each effective drawing, B with D lines, and I get the trace invariant operator down here. So what I need to evaluate now, it's a Gaussian integral with this Gaussian measure and these insertions, you know. So how do I do it? Well, I'll first put the scalings and the coupling constants in front. Product Ti n to the d minus 1 minus 2 by d minus 2 factorial. Now, Pi. OK. Now, recall about this invariance, you know? These invariants, they were for each graph, given graph, they were a sum over all indices you could see, you know? A product, well, for every vertex, V, let's say these are the white vertices, you picked up a T and entry, which had, you know, the indices n1, nd. Then for every v bar, you had a tensor entry t bar with n1, nd. And let's put here a small index v bar, v bar. Okay, so these were the tensors corresponding to the vertices. And then for all the lines in this graph, you had an identification. So for that was a product of all the lines, you know. So let's say product over E from 1 to D, product over the lines, which go from a vertex to a vertex bar, delta of the index I on the vertex V with the index I on the vertex V bar. Good. So we each drawing had white vertices, had black vertices, and had lines. The lines correspond to these deltas here, you know, 1, 2, 3, and so on. Good. So I will expand this guy, you know, what I will get. So my Gaussian integral will have this as insertion. So how does the Gaussian integral evaluate? It evaluates by computing weak contractions. So what I will need to do is to build weak contractions of these tensors T and T bars associated to the vertices, you know. So weak contraction is a pairing. What does it mean to make a weak contraction, you know, a weak contraction It comes at picking a T and a T bar somewhere, you know, in all these invariants, you know. I take a T which has some indices, you know. Let's say N1 and D. A T bar with indices Q1, QD. And the V contraction comes to replacing them by the covariance. So V contraction comes to taking these guys and replacing them by an identification of all the indices times the scaling factor. 1 over n to the power d minus 1. And here I have identification n1 with q1 up to nd with qd. So what I do is that these guys, they act as effective. I would avoid calling them vertices because the white and the black vertices are called vertices. These guys act as effective interactions which get connected by something new, something different, weak contractions of indices of tensors 2x2. So what I'll be doing, I'll be giving a graphical representation of such a weak contraction in the following way. You know, so when I pick up, let's say, a tensor T bar here, and the tensor T on some other invariant. So let's draw here a different invariant, you know. If they two get, if these two get paired, I will represent this by a dashed line in a V contraction. So now I compute my path integral. This will act as, you know, propagators or V contractions. So these are propagators. Dashed, represented dashed, they are an extra line which did not exist before in my invariant. You know? Now you see that these dashed lines, they are very different with respect to the other line. So namely, they bring this factor here. And moreover, what they bring is an identification of all the indices of the two tensors. So when I see a dashed line, this represents an identification of the index, you know, 1 here with the 1 here, on the index 2 here with the index 2 here, and the index 3 here with the index 3 here. So it's a delta n to q2 delta n 3 q. So each of these guys, you know, because of this Gaussian measure, it's an identification of all the indices of the two tensors. So when I expand my graph, you know, my partition function will write as a sum over graphs. My free energy will write as a sum over connected graphs. So from now on, I'll just talk about connected graphs. I expand my Feynman graphs. If I compute their amplitudes, I need to track several things. First, I need to track the scalings here. Then I need to track the scaling coming from these contractions. And then I need to track my delta functions. And I have two categories of delta functions. Those which were hidden in my invariants, which were one identification per solid line. And those which are hidden in this propagator, in this weak contraction, which is the identification of everybody along this dashed line. Am I clear or not? OK. So let me represent a Feynman graph. That's the action. What can I sacrifice? OK, I'll sacrifice. No. OK, I'll sacrifice this one. You have the action, and you have there the evaluation. OK, good. So to represent my Feynman graphs, I will add this extra dashed line of color 0. So if I just represent a full graph, I will have this extra dashed line of color 0. Now, let's say, like an example, this is 0, 1, 2. This was the 3, 2, 1, 3. And let's say that these two dashed lines of color 0, they go here, 1, 2, 3. So this, for instance, it's a representation of a Feynman graph, you know, where I connected a connected Feynman graph, you know, where I added these lines of color 0 for everybody. I contracted all my tensors here, you know. So there are two things to understand about this drawing, which has an extra color. So first of all, we need to understand something about its topological interpretation. What does it represent, such a Feynman graph? And second, we need to compute its amplitude. So about the topological interpretation, now look that if I just look at this thing, you know, this guy is an extra color called zero, you know, so it looks like a graph with four colors. So it looks very much like the, you know, like a gluing of tetrahedra. If I'm starting with tensors with three indices, the drawing with three colors looks like a surface. Now, because I added the fourth color, it looks like a space. No? So it's obviously, it looks like a three-dimensional space this time, having four colors, as it has four colors. So one should, you know, one could ask itself, what is this three-dimensional space? Now, there are two ways to see it. Either A, you know, I just play the game I explained there, you know. I take my tetrahedra, I assign to them colors 0, 1, 2, and 3, you know, and I obtain this gluing of tetrahedra to get a three-dimensional space. Now, a second question is, well, but we actually knew already that this guy, they represent surfaces. And this is a way to glue surfaces together. How can you glue surfaces and obtain spaces in three dimensions? So the secret is the following. When I drew these surfaces associated to the graphs with three colors, I put a triangle for each vertex, trivalent vertex, you know, 1, 2, 3. So now, adding these lines of color 0, these propagators, you know, makes that my vertices will now look like this, 0, 1, let's put 2 here, and 3. Now, what I've been doing by adding this extra line of color 0 is that I took the topological cone over this triangle. So this one was a triangle with labeled edges, you know, 1, 2, and 3. Taking the topological cone over it, well, the topological cone over a triangle, it's a tetrahedron. Now, the original triangle will now be called the triangle of color 0. No, this is the extra color I get, it's for the original triangle. The edge of color 1, you know, when it coned into a full triangle. So the edge of color 1, by coning, gave the color, the triangle of color 1 behind there, you know. The edge of color 2, by coning, gave this triangle of color 2 here, and the edge of color 3, the triangle of color 3, and so on. So the way in which I can understand the fact that I went from surfaces to three-dimensional objects is that each surface is a gluing of triangles. When I add the zeros, I take the topological cone over these surfaces, I obtain some three-dimensional chunks, which then I glue according to this pattern. So this is why, you know, starting from surfaces, I get spaces, you know, from the gluing these arbitrary chunks. You know, the advantage being that my tensor models models all these possible chunks, you know, so I can build my space by gluing these arbitrary chunks together. No? Good. So this one was the one, back there, and this one was the three, and so on. Good. Okay, so adding this extra line of color 0 comes to taking topological cone. Now, obviously, you know, if I go in higher dimensions, in the tensors with D indices, when I build Feynman graphs, I will add an extra color. The tensors with D indices will represent gluing of D minus 1 pseudomanifolds, and with the extra color, I take the cone and I get gluings of D dimensional things, you know. So this is why three indices leads to three-dimensional spaces and four colors. Good. So this is about the, how to understand topologically these drawings. Now, how about amplitudes? So I will spare you a bit the effort. Just the remark is the following. If I start tracking my delta function identifications, I see that I pick up one identification for an index along a line of color 1. Then it gets identified along the dashed line, because the dashed line identifies everybody. Then this index continues along the line of color 1. Then it goes on another dashed line, then on an index of color 1, then on a dashed line, and so on and so forth. So you see that the delta functions, they chain along the subgraphs with colors 0 and 1. So what you know, besides all the scaling I put, these complicated delta functions in the Feynman graph, they will all give me an n, a free sum for every cycle of color 0 and I. Now, obviously, you know, it's the number of cycles or faces, if you want, with colors 0 and I in the graph can be seen as the total number of faces minus the number of faces of the graphs having colors 1, 2, and 3. because these ones have all the other colors except the ones which contain zero. Putting everything together and the computing, I get that the amplitude of a graph with these scalings is n, the large n, to the power the dimension minus 2 by d minus 1 factorial times the degree of the Feynman graph. Recall that this guy has d plus 1 colors. So this is for the most generic model, you know, with this scaling chosen here, take any arbitrary graph, this is what you get. Now, why is this important? So first of all, it's important because the degree is a positive number. So this thing, it's at most n to the power d or smaller. So this is a 1 over n expansion. It starts at n to the power d, and then you get corrections. Now, second reason for which is important is that if you take d equal 2, you recall that, you know, here you get 2, here you get 2, and 2 plus 1, 3 colors were ribbon graphs, and the degree was the genus. So it coincides with the usual 1 over n expansion in the genus in matrix models. And third is that it is dominated by graphs of degree 0, which are graphs, no. These graphs, they always represent spheres in any dimensions. In three dimensions, it's easy to see. You recall that this degree was the sum of genera of splitting surfaces. And it's enough to have a splitting surface, which is a sphere, in order to state that your three-dimensional closed guy is a sphere. So, well, in higher dimensions, it's a bit more involved, but one can prove that these graphs of degree 0 are spheres in arbitrary dimensions. Yes, the degree is the sum of the sinus of the genus of the jacket. If it is zero, as all the genera are, you know, at least zero, it means that all of them are zero, so at least one of them is zero, and it's enough to have one which is zero in order to state that the thing is a sphere. So it's not only that it's spheres, but it's an extremely particular class of spheres. It's a very restricted, you know, type of sphere. You get a degree zero. So, okay. So this is where I'd be stopping. Now, if you have questions. Yes, so, yes?
Then nevertheless, the entire thing is completely symmetric and
well, not exactly.
Or is there some special...
So, not exactly. Because if you look at the amplitudes, they see faces which contain the color zero, but not the others. So, a priori, this thing is not symmetric over all the colors. The thing which rendered it symmetric, and you lost that completely in this formula, is that I wisely chose my scalings here.
So this is this is the amplitude,
this is the amplitude, yes. And this amplitude does not see the difference between zero and the other. But the reason for which it does not see the difference is that I chose these scalings here. Had I not chosen them, it would have been a more different stuff, which would have seen the color zero. But then, you know, it would have had here a longer expression. You can, of course, do that, and you can track the...
I don't know, you know, then maybe it's distinguishing one dimension or something, but I don't know.
You can, of course, try to distinguish one color. I don't know exactly, you know, so I can write for you a formula which distinguishes certainly, because, you know, it basically is this corrected by this kind of terms. But then, here you have a suppression. These kind of corrections, they come with a plus, because here I have, you know, I put small suppressions. And I need to prove to you further that the exponent is bounded and so on and so forth. Can be done, a bit involved. So,
but spontaneously, would we have an application if you pick out one color?
So, you want to distinguish very much a color, call it zero.
Yeah.
So, each of the chunks here represents a, you know, three-dimensional space, and when you glue it represents what? It represents a chunk of three-dimensional space, you know, a ton of tetrahedra glued together. And what you tell me is that I distinguish a color zero, so when I glue these chunks together, I do something very weird in this gluing. So whereas the tetrahedra together in the chunk, they are glued very nicely, when I start gluing the chunks together, I do something weird. Okay, so I don't know exactly what you get, but it does not privilege a direction or anything, you know? It's just that you have these chunks, arbitrary chunks, and when you glue these arbitrary chunks together, you want to do some. Okay.
Can you draw the gluing of the chunks?
Okay, so that requires a bit more drawing. start with a precise example, which is a nice example. So I want to start to draw something which is easy to draw as a graph, as a triangulation, as everything. So what I'll be drawing for you is the following thing, you know. So this is a graph with three colors, you know. So let's assign here white, black, black, white, white, 1, 3, 3, 2, 1, 1, 1. 3, 2, 1, 1. So this is a gluing of 8 trivalent vertices. So it's a gluing of 8 triangles. So I'll first draw you a surface glued, you know, obtained by gluing 8 triangles together, you know. So each of these guys is dual to a triangle. Good. So this gluing of 8 triangles is the gluing dual to this drawing. How do you see it? Well, so this vertex here is dual to this triangle, and you have the edges 1, no, sorry, this is the 2 here. So you have 2, 3, and 1. So this guy here is this guy here. Okay, then you have 4 of them glued together around the point. So these are the 4 upper triangles glued around this guy here. You have the same figure down. So you have 4 triangles glued around this guy down here. And then you have everything glued together along the things of color 1, you know, which is the gluing of these 2 things together. So this is a surface paved by 8 triangles. You see it? Now what I'll be doing, I'll be adding a color 0 on it. So I'll be taking this drawing. Before gluing it to anything else, I'll just add the color 0. So now I add the color 0 here. And I'll see later on what I do with it. So taking, adding the color 0 comes to taking the topological cone over this thing. So this means what? It means that here, you know, I just promote my guys to tetrahedra. Now this vertex here, having the color 0, will correspond to the full tetrahedron here, which is the tetrahedron plus these guys inside. Now, this is the vertex of color 0. The half line of color 0, which remained here outside, represents what used to be the triangle, you know, will now become the triangle of color 0. So now you have a gluing of tetrahedra in a ball, bounded, you know, by these 8 triangles, each of them, you know, coming from one of the tetrahedron glued together. This guy over here is the apex of your cone, you know, inside in the middle, no? So now imagine that I have this chunk, I have another chunk exactly like it, and I just glue them together along these triangles of color 0. And this is how I glue my chunks together. This gluing of tetrahedra is the three-dimensional chunk, and it gets glued along its boundary with other chunks. Am I explicit enough or not? So imagine that I have the same picture, you know, but in a mirror here. No. Yes, but this is not a matrix model. Because what I wrote for you, I wrote a tensor invariant, because I need, in order to interpret this graph as a gluing of triangles, I need the 3 colors. Without my colors, 1, 2, and 3, I cannot interpret this as a unique gluing of triangles. So I can build, I can glue for you triangles if I put tensors. But what this gives me, you know, tensors with 3 indices, it gives me that their invariants are surfaces. The Feynman graphs are not, because the Feynman graphs get this extra color, you know, which makes them to become three-dimensional things. But I needed to start with a tensor with 3 indices. It's not a matrix. I really need the tensor, you know, to represent its invariants like this with colors and associate surfaces.
Because you expect the final graph to be the same thing as the same nature of the input interaction.
In
so you know, the invariants of our surfaces, the final graph becomes the different nature.
Not really, because if you
what you expect, what you expect is that the boundary of your Feynman graph is what you put your in your interaction.
Yeah. When
it's not the full Feynman graph. It's the boundary that must be like what you put in, and the boundary of a three-dimensional thing, it's a two-dimensional stuff. The graph itself, no, because the graph has two things, has interactions and propagators.
So zero is the boundary.
If you want, zero is like the bulk, yes.
But and the boundary of that guy is not the manifold. It looks like there's one to three, these are manifold. The way you draw it, there's no boundary.
This one?
No, the
this one here?
No, the one in the middle.
What? This one? This one is this one, before gluing. So it still has zeros.
Yeah, but after the gluing.
Now I start gluing zeros on top of each other. So let's say that I'm starting to amuse myself, you know. Let's imagine that I glue this zero on this zero. This comes to gluing this triangle on the triangle down here, you know. And let's imagine that I do it once. Twice for this pair here, you know?
So
three times for this pair here,
yeah.
And four times for the pair here. If I did it completely, I get something with no boundary.
But now if I have boundaries, the boundaries are all labeled by zeros. Yeah.
Yes?
But that's not what you were starting from. You started from an action which is labeled by 1, 2, 3.
Yes, because so the boundaries. Wait. The boundaries have half lines of color zero, which touch vertices. Now the vertices here, they have 1, 2, and 3, and they go on and on and on. Now I draw the boundary graph of this graph. What do I do if I draw the boundary graph? So I want to draw the, you know, the graph of the boundary of this drawing. For every external line, I draw a vertex, no? Which will acquire the color 0 if 1. For every what you call strand, for every cycle, I draw a line in the boundary graph. So these guys automatically get labeled, you know, because the cycles which contain zero, they are either 0, 1, or 0, 2, or 0, 3. When I draw the boundary graph, they become 1, 2, and 3. They become exactly colored with the initial colors, if I look at the boundary graph. So the thing, you understand? I can, once I look at the boundary, the zero is redundant, I erase it all over the place, I get a 1, 2, 3 thing, which is exactly of the formula before. Yes. It's been 1.5 hours, so you know.